Russia. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very glad to have with me in the studios today Dr. Art Sear Clawson, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country. And as Dave McGrath and I were remarking earlier this morning, there is nobody who has been a more frequent guest to the morning show than Professor Sear. And we're always glad to have him here to touch on an array of important issues and events pertaining to our nation and our world, for that matter. And we appreciate the perspective that he brings. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always nice to be with you, and it's nice to be invited back.
Glad we can have this conversation. So we are just past yet another Memorial Day weekend. And, of course, it is one of those holidays that, sadly, not everybody takes the time to really ponder. I mean, it, for many people, is not a whole lot more than just a day off. And, of course, Memorial Day is meant to be much, much more than that. And you gave Memorial Day some attention in one of your most recent columns. And in that column, you made some really interesting observations about one of the towering masterworks of human history, namely Homer's The Iliad and the Odyssey. And explain to our listeners what you think those two works represent and how they speak to the experience of the typical veteran.
It's a classic work, and classics endure for very good reasons. And I'm particularly glad to have an opportunity to talk about the importance of liberal arts generally at a time when Americans, even more than in the past, seem to be focusing on vocationalism and a rather narrow-gauge approach to work. It's worth making the point that in this country, and in Britain and others, but especially in the Anglosphere, liberal arts undergraduates tend to run large institutions, including in the business, corporate world, as well as in education and the significantly growing nonprofit sector and, of course, public service. Understanding the past really does help you deal with the present and the future. The two classics, The Iliad and The Odyssey, by the ancient poet Homer, dealt with the Trojan War, a very important strategic war, a very important war in terms of how it influenced history in the Mediterranean and therefore more generally. An author who had a impressive grasp of military operations in ancient times, military tricks as well as tactics and strategy. The Trojan horse actually existed and is a metaphor for all kinds of things in human life, related to my earlier point. Yeah. And then the Odyssey. after the Greeks won the war, the long voyage home of Ulysses and his warriors. It's a metaphor for the reintegration of warriors after military service and especially heavy armed combat. And it continues to resonate because those problems don't change. Mm. Very good book that I read some years ago, Achilles in Vietnam, by a psychiatrist, did a very good job not only in a not in an academic sense of discussing ancient literature and ancient history, but relating the durable characteristics of the human condition to what, for me, at that point was a very contemporary experience.
Hmm. I'm reminded also in your column of the contrast you drew between what the return home for some soldiers was like versus the return of soldiers from other conflicts in which it was not a triumphant welcome home, and in some cases, exactly the opposite. And I guess I it's one of those things where you sort of know that, and yet you don't stop to think about the stark contrast, and especially how unfortunate the return was for soldiers, for instance, returning from the Vietnam War.
Yes, absolutely. Well, hostility to the Vietnam War, which grew steadily in this country and then really became enormously powerful after the revolutionaries in Vietnam launched the Tet Offensive during the Lunar New Year in 1968. Militarily, actually a defeat for them, but politically, as calculated by Hanoi, an enormous success. Public opinion doesn't change that rapidly in this country on major issues, a saving grace in our turbulent society. Hmm. Then and now and throughout our history, public support for the war collapsed very, very quickly. And again, hostility to the war became very focused and at times very unpleasant hostility to our military. The Pentagon, for understandable reasons, during the Johnson administration, ordered military, encouraged and at times ordered military personnel not to discuss their activities, not to wear a uniform in public, and not to do anything that in any way comments on the war, which with 2020 hindsight made things more difficult for military people from that time later on. Mm. With the end of conscription, a very important, bold strategic move by President Richard Nixon, who ended conscription in 1973, In a very skillful way, which we can discuss in more detail if you wish, we now have an all professional military. The kind of public pressures related to an unpopular war were in effect wiped out. We also have had leaders since that time who have been very, very reluctant for understandable political reasons to get drawn into, to intervene in, to get sucked into a military conflict that will potentially lead to very large casualties. The single exception is the Gulf War, where I believe President George H.W. Bush and his very talented associates, Secretary of State James Baker, Colin Powell, head of the Joint Chiefs, and I grudgingly admit Defense Secretary Cheney, they did commit us to what could have been a very, very costly long-term war. Mm. Fortunately for everybody, not just Americans, that didn't happen.
And one thing you point out in this same column is that in some of our more recent conflicts in which we've been engaged, by no means to the same extent, but there was fairly significant opposition to those conflicts. I mean, widespread protests in some cases. But those protests or that displeasure with America being engaged in something like the Iraqi War, for instance, was not directed at soldiers returning home the same way that displeasure about the Vietnam War, so much of that displeasure was focused on the soldiers returning home, which was just simply unjust in hindsight.
Very well put. As usual, you said succinctly what I was trying to communicate very, very effectively. It also underscores the importance of political leadership at any time. Memorial Day dates from the Civil War, quite appropriately. More than 600,000 Americans died in that war, our most costly war, even more costly than World War II, by about a third. Mm. The leadership of Lincoln is generally recognized and applauded today, still not exclusively, but since World War II, at least, we've had a real consensus in this country about that war, quite rightly. I mentioned the first Gulf War. President George H.W. Bush was very, very careful to consult with Congress. It just barely passed authorization. We haven't had a declaration of war, actually, since World War II, but it was there was tremendous opposition to it. By contrast, the his son's successful effort to get authorization from Congress to invade Iraq passed by significant margins. It shows the complexity of these matters and the fact that what's clear in hindsight isn't always clear at the time.
For sure.
But that's a very, you put it very well, as usual. I always learn a lot from this program. Thank you.
I do want to ask you about something you say about the all-professional military. But maybe ahead of that, I'll invite you, since you essentially offered to explain a little more about what Mr. Nixon did back in 1973 when he essentially eliminated the draft. And you say he did so skillfully. How so?
Yes, indeed. William Westmoreland was the very prominent, very... Even for a four-star, very PR-conscious, he looked like the general from Central Casting. Very tall, very good-looking, very commanding. A very limited man, in my biased opinion, in important ways. He was the field commander in Vietnam from 64 to 68. After Tet, President Johnson very graciously kicked him upstairs and made him chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Westmoreland was, with 20/20 hindsight, was not... In many ways, he was a particularly bad choice as field commander in Vietnam. He was an ideal chief of staff of the Army. He was very talented in organization and planning, especially in a non-combat context. He had been to Harvard Business School, and which is part of what they call ticket punching. As an officer, you're encouraged to go to graduate school. My impression is they tended not to go to business school, which the professional military types tend to find rather boring. Westmoreland really enjoyed Harvard Business School. He excelled at it. He tried very hard to make the U.S. Army more like a 60s-style corporation, which is one of the military brass generally not only disliked but despised Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense under Kennedy and Johnson. I'm not exaggerating. Westmoreland and McNamara had a very good relationship by all accounts that I've heard as well as read, and I think it's because of that corporate approach that Westmoreland had. He and a man named Bill Depew, who was the real driving force intellectually of the air mobile strategy that we pursued unsuccessfully under LBJ in Vietnam, he likewise had considerable organizational ability. And this tremendous job of transforming the mammoth U.S. Army and the wider military, but especially the Army, which has the bulk of the people, the women and men, as opposed to weapons and quantifiable non-human factors, they worked together to transform the institution very smoothly into an all-volunteer force, a mammoth undertaking, and it happened without any great difficulty.
In that column, when reflecting on this now all-professional military that we have, we've talked before about how one effect that's unfortunate is how it has tended to kind of segregate the military from the rest of society.
And yes.
It's a smaller and smaller proportion of society. But you also said this in turn facilitates frequent personnel rotation overseas, a problem that developed during the Clinton administration. I wonder if you could just explain what that connection is.
We began intervening very aggressively, in addition to our large number of military bases around the world. We began to send military personnel to all parts of the world. To make a more contemporary point, one of Vladimir Putin's more dramatic and effective gestures is he will do this rather regularly before audiences on television in person. Spin a globe and put his finger on it without looking at it and say, I guarantee you the odds are the Central Intelligence Agency and the American government more widely, including their military, are active. They are involved in this part of the world. Clinton, who I believe was not only a political genius, that's self-evident, but an extraordinarily successful policy president and legislative leader. He's right up there with LBJ in terms of getting legislation through Congress, even though the Republicans were in charge most of the time. He rather cynically started sending our military willy-nilly hither and yon overseas, and related to the Iliad and especially the Odyssey, the emotional stress and tremendous psychological problems that are undeniable really began to afflict our military in a big way starting in the Clinton years.
And,
I alluded to that.
And are you saying that because it was by that point an all-professional military, he felt freer to do that? I mean, like
Once again, you get at the kernel of things. I must say, I'm not just trying to butter you up, but yes, it's easier for politicians to do what every successful politician does effectively, which is wheel and deal. It's much easier to use our military this way when you have an all-volunteer force.
Interesting. Finally, from that same column, I think, end with an interesting point where in which you say, we should, at least in general, really encourage our veterans to run for political office, that is, or public office. You would like to see more veterans in public office. As you make that point, you point out that from Truman to the elder President Bush, all of those presidents in an unbroken line were all military veterans.
And to a significant degree, combat veterans.
Yeah.
And
of course, we've not had a veteran since.
Right.
But you believe, and I think rightly, that the typical veteran at least potentially brings great skills and perspectives to public service, to public office. Just expand on what you're talking about there. What you think veterans have to offer.
Because they know what it's really like, and they're not so inclined to be theoretical about things. Mm. It's dating from the Civil War, even before, but especially after the Civil War, we had an almost unbroken, fairly sizable contingent of men in Congress who had served in the military in some capacity and had that kind of real world or unreal world, depending on your point of view. They had that undeniable practical experience. And with the all-volunteer military, the end of Vietnam, and our successful aversion of very large wars, even the Gulf War involved a huge amount of personnel, but the casualties were phenomenally low on our side, on the Allied side. Only one person that I'm aware of, John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago, Mearsheimer. This is a guy you should really pay attention to, also a military veteran and an academy graduate. He's the only one who predicted that we would be so successful in the first Gulf War. Even in the Pentagon's best case scenarios had us losing a couple thousand men in combat. That's kind of a separate subject, but it underscores the main point that you very effectively made. We have also had steady growth of intellectuals in government, starting especially with the New Deal, and they have a lot to add, but starting with the Kennedy administration, especially in my view, you had a lot of very academic types, often very young, exclusively men as far as I know, playing a very powerful role in defense policy. It's one reason the brass was so hostile to McNamara, among others. And that has continued. The rise of the neocons is the same phenomenon. Men and women much more recently who had zero military experience but had very strong views on how things should be done.
Hmm. Interesting contrast.
Yeah, and a very important one in terms of our politics and
sure,
the costs involved.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, and we're touching on a number of important issues and events. President Biden is just back from an extensive trip to Asia, and of course, Asia is a part of the world you know an awful lot about, and you are always careful to remind us that that Asia is such a significant world player, and our presence there is significant. Tell us more about what President Biden hoped to accomplish on this most recent trip to Asia.
Well, the stops and principal goal was to consult with our vital allies, South Korea, which has a new president, and Japan, which has a new prime minister. The organization called the Quad, Q-U-A-D, set up in 2017, a couple of earlier efforts failed. And that brings together India, Australia, Japan, and the good old USA in terms of regular consultation on strategic matters. The fact that these four countries are involved underscores the vast geographic distances, a lot of them involving water, in the Pacific that makes it fundamentally different from Europe in terms of strategic challenges and also opportunities for us. But the steady rise of China in military terms, especially their maritime capacities, as well as, of course, they're very powerful, an extraordinarily successful overall economy is a big incentive for putting together an organization like this. Europe and the Atlantic area, since shortly after World War II, have a rather tight network and durable network of economic and military organizations. The NATO alliance, much in the news today because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but also the European Union and its predecessors have been around for a long time. They're very successful. We have struggled since shortly after World War II, but especially since the end of the Cold War, to try to reproduce these organizations in the Pacific theater. It's an important and fascinating topic, and one that, as you implied, should be discussed more.
Absolutely. Almost immediately upon returning from his trip, President Biden and his wife journeyed down to Uvalde, Texas, in the wake of that terrible, horrific mass shooting in the Robb Elementary School there in Uvalde, Texas. What is there to say about something so unspeakably tragic?
Well, there's far too much speculation and biased discussion in the media, I'm willing to say. I think it's an opportunity like Memorial Day for reflection, and it's extremely unfortunate that media people use, including on public radio, in my view, use it as an opportunity to ride the hobby horse of their own views and sound self-righteous. I have thought about it, partly because I thought you might ask about it. Amid all the rhetoric, a couple of things could be done that aren't much discussed. I think raising dramatically the minimum age to own firearms across the board would be a very good idea, to 25 or 30, given the terrible problem we have today with young males who become quite violent and the ready availability of firearms. I'm sure it would be tested and challenged. If the gun lobby has any sense, they wouldn't make a big deal out of it. The Constitution includes the right to bear arms, but the Second Amendment doesn't say anything about age. And it's quite separate, in my mind, from 18 years old is the vote in military service. We could also be much more aggressive in starting with the Justice Department in pursuing the interstate commerce dimensions of black market arms sales. If you put the power of the Justice Department behind something that the public supports, it's possible to make tremendous progress. Chicago has among the toughest gun laws in the nation, as red state politicians like to point out. The mayor of Chicago and others point out that surrounding states are much more lax in this regard. Well, using the power of the federal government to much more aggressively search out, confiscate, and prosecute people who are, in one way or another, engaging in illegal gun sales is something that makes a lot of sense to me. Robert Kennedy, if you're aware of the history, you may or may not be a supporter of his record politically and in the Justice Department. People had strong views about him during his life, but putting the full weight of the Justice Department behind prosecution of organized crime had a phenomenal effect over a short period of time in the early 60s, from very, very few major gangsters going to prison. There were approximately 350 major figures in the mafia who had not only been indicted and tried, but convicted by the federal government during the Kennedy administration. It went to a crashing halt after Dallas, but that's one dramatic example, and there are others, of what the federal government can achieve. I'm sure it would be legally challenged. That's fine. It'll get people's attention to focus more beyond the endless and, to me, very offensive biased political rhetoric about gun control.
Interesting.
Well, I'm glad it is, and I hope it's thought-provoking, because we really should be thinking seriously about this.
Well, and it sounds like what one of the reasons you're raising what you are is that these are maybe plausible possibilities. I mean, more
exactly.
plausible than others.
Yeah.
I mean, and you also believe that they would make a significant difference.
And a way of getting beyond Mitch McConnell, who I think is a commendable political leader and public spirit in other ways, beyond McConnell and the other Republicans piously saying you're in our thoughts and prayers, and then they don't do a damn thing about trying to address this very, very serious problem in our country, and a terrible plague, and what affects children. Children should be off limits. Children should be off limits to political activism, social activism, sexual activism, if I may say so. Children are off limits, and a terrible tragedy like this, if we're mature adults, could lead to some improvement in public policy. I hope that's not too blunt
right.
for public radio.
Not at all. Not at all. I share your hope that we can find our way forward here. Let's talk about Mr. Vladimir Putin. You outlined some alarming public statements that he recently made, which essentially conveyed the possibility that, depending on how things go with Ukraine, he didn't consider the utilization of nuclear weapons in that conflict to be off the record, or off the table,
off
I
limits.
Should say. Off limits, yeah. So in talking about that and our own government's statements in response to that, you point out something that, and I think you're absolutely right, that it's something that was done quietly and was all but ignored, and that is something which happened back in January when Moscow and Washington signed an important agreement that had already been in place but extended it for a few years. And I think you're right. This is something nobody is talking about. Explain to our listeners what happened back in January.
Well, both Washington and Moscow agreed, and because it's such a serious matter, the politicians involved should be commended. Putin and associates, as well as the Biden administration, agreed to an extension of what's called New START, that is policed limitations on major strategic weapon systems, including especially intercontinental ballistic missiles. Other agreements, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Agreement that Reagan and Gorbachev achieved in 1987. This is a complicated subject, and I'm not an expert on this. So forgive me if I hesitate. The Russians have blatantly violated that. And under Putin, it's been generally more and more difficult to try to begin any serious arms negotiations or other kind of negotiations. And as the Russians continue to be mired in Ukraine, I think that'll only continue to be the case. But both sides agreed to this strategic arms agreement. Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger deserve a great deal of credit. In policy terms, that's going to be Nixon's redemption, I believe. Not everyone agrees with that, but the policy record is just phenomenal. The first significant strategic arms limitation agreement were the SALT treaties, strategic arms. The acronyms are even more, even better than in the military. These arms negotiators come up with these. Anyway, SALT, strategic arms limitation talks, resulted in not a reduction in missiles, but at least in terms of launching vehicles. The Soviets and the Americans agreed to cap that. And also defensive anti-ballistic weapon systems, which were exotic and not very reliable compared to today. But the Soviets loved them. And if it hadn't been for SALT, they would have proliferated all over the place. Nixon and Kissinger, and a very fine gentleman by the name of Winston Lord, by the way, who who did an awful lot of the actual work, Kissinger's right-hand man, they were able to cap the arms race. Reagan built his political career in part on attacking softness toward communism and denouncing these agreements. But lo and behold, what does he do? Soon after he becomes president, especially in his second term, he really pursues arms agreements with the Soviets, which resulted in the INF Treaty, and that momentum led to the first START Treaty, which I believe focused much more on the weapons themselves, with steadily greater ability to verify things, not necessarily on the ground, as opposed to just launching pads. John Kennedy deserves a great deal of credit for the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Believe it or not, until 1963, the Soviets and ourselves, and increasingly the French, were setting off these things, literally poisoning our human system, setting off these things in the atmosphere. And in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis, among their last significant acts, Kennedy and Khrushchev were able to get together in the summer of 63 to finally end this terrible practice. Eisenhower, as usual, shows up. The first significant arms agreement, I believe, was the demilitarization of Antarctica in 1959, a very positive byproduct of IGGY, the International Geophysical Year, I believe, 58-59. World scientists, spurred by the Americans with a lot of help from the British, got together for a comprehensive series of conferences that led to identifying the Van Allen radiation belt, which nobody knew about before, in space. And also Ike took the opportunity for what I believe is the first significant nuclear strategic military agreement with the Soviets. Whatever the president, every president, starting with Truman, starting with Roosevelt, in some ways, has pursued arms limitation and arms agreement.
In that column, which in which you outline all of this in very clear fashion, you say one thing that may catch people a little by surprise when you say reductions are desirable, that is, reductions in these terrible nuclear weapons, but efforts to outlaw all nuclear weapons are fundamentally flawed. In other words, and I think Reagan was somebody you said that actually publicly called for that in some kind of statement, but you're actually saying that that kind of goal does not necessarily make sense.
No, it upset everybody, not just in the Pentagon and the arms control community, but in the State Department especially. The guy who keeps one or a few nuclear weapons hidden in the basement, and who knows, a Russian leader might decide to do something like that. Their record isn't so great in this regard, but not necessarily Putin or whoever succeeds him. But it is inherently destabilizing. Gorbachev and Reagan got together in Reykjavik, Iceland, which led to the INF Treaty, but they also made a grand public statement which set the staffs on both sides up in the air, that why don't we get rid of all nuclear weapons? How about that, Mikhail? Yes, Ronnie, we should do this. That's politics. I think at some level Reagan really believed that. He was a very curious. I had the honor of being around him twice, and once at close quarters. He was a very curious man, very attractive guy in person, I must say, very engaging, but unlike most politicians in my experience. But he had a very curious approach to the world. It was something he would come up with and believe it.
Interesting.
It is interesting.
You also in a...
Because it deals with leadership personalities, which tend to be different from others.
Absolutely, for sure. In a different column, you also touch on Mr. Putin in a different matter, and this relates to NATO, and specifically to the most recent expansion of NATO. And I'm trying to remember now if that's a done deal or if the wheels are still turning.
I don't think it's done yet, unless it's been done late last night.
Right. But this would involve both Finland and Sweden being added to NATO or joining NATO. And this is, you talk about this in the context of a column in which you essentially outline not only NATO's creation back in 1949.
Yes. But you get an A for the day.
But then these points in time when NATO has rather dramatically expanded. And as I think we've maybe touched on before, but it bears repeating, this is at the heart of Mr. Putin's concerns and how he is justifying, for instance, this military action against Ukraine. Explain the dynamics that are going on there in which NATO is seen as such a threat, and what sort of deep-seated fears is that connected to?
I think that's a very important question, because we Americans are so secure, relatively speaking, whatever we may feel at work or at home or from day to day, individually and collectively, we are a very secure country. General Patton quite wisely said, when oceans and mountain ranges have been overcome, anything built by man can be overcome, referring to the Siegfried Line and his staff's concern about punching through the German fortifications near the border. Third Army rolled through everything. He was right. But geography still does matter, and the two oceans that protect us, along with historically extraordinarily friendly nations to our north and south, at least since the Civil War.
Sure.
At least since World War I. The Germans tried very hard to turn Mexico into an ally. It's hard for us to understand the tremendous fear, indeed paranoia, that afflicts some other nations in the world. And after Barbarossa, the gigantic, almost unbelievable German armored invasion of the Soviet Union, surprise attack by their ally in June 41, and Napoleon's invasion in 1812. Those are two dramatic examples of what has happened historically to them. There is a paranoia about their security concerns, which is very real. That's all I was referring to. The first Bush administration, which I believe strongly was a very successful administration in foreign policy in a revolutionary time, they committed not to deploying nuclear weapons in Eastern Europe. They did not commit to in any way restraining NATO, but they did not push for Eastern expansion. Clinton did the opposite with his advisors, in particular Madeleine Albright, in my opinion. And we started pushing NATO right up to Russia's border in 1999 with Poland and several other countries, the Czech Republic and Hungary, I think.
Yeah.
I believe that was a mistake. But I also think with Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, all bets are off. And there are very good reasons in a changed situation to expand NATO. And Sweden, a annoyingly neutral country in our lifetimes, since World War II and before for a couple of hundred years, but especially starting with the Vietnam War, Sweden has been a very annoying neutral. Finland is a country in a very tough spot bordering Russia, as are the Baltics, and the Baltics have joined NATO. So given Putin's behavior, I think this expansion is fully justified, but his behavior is understandable in terms of wider Russian anxieties. I hope that's clear, but it's right. Very hard for us Americans to really accept that. How would we feel if Mexico or Canada suddenly decided to ally with China or Russia, and suddenly Chinese People's Liberation Army troops were south of the border in Mexico, which is what the Germans worked very hard to achieve before and during World War I, and thanks to British intelligence, they were headed off.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's important to see how we Americans tend to think everybody wants to be an American. I heard that once in the Army from a senior officer who definitely did not care for me very much. Trouble with you, Lieutenant, you don't realize these people want to be Americans. We got to help these people understand how to be Americans. He was not a stupid man. He was not all that bright, but that's, to me, that's a more general American mindset.
Wow. Yeah, he may not have been stupid, but that was a pretty stupid thing to say.
It was. Yeah. But we tend to feel that way, and a lot of people, there are millions of people who are trying very hard to get into this country all the time. A lot of people do want to be Americans, but that doesn't mean that we can reproduce ourselves in far corners of the world.
Right. I'm so glad you pointed out, too, I think a lot of us are to varying degrees, very mindful of those expansive oceans and, in a sense, the protection that they offer. But I don't think we stop to think as much as we should about that matter of a friendly neighbor to the north and a friendly neighbor to the south, how that is also so significant in terms of us being relatively secure within our own borders compared to a lot of other places around the world where right across the border from you is somebody that you might view with great suspicion or even hostility. We have a very, very different situation from most places around the world, actually.
Yeah.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. And in our waning minutes here of the hour, I want to be sure that we have time to talk about some recent elections that were quite significant. One election that I followed fairly closely and the other that I really didn't follow closely at all. So I'm so glad that you wrote about the recent elections in Britain. I guess the reason they were kind of off the radar of most Americans like me is because these were local elections, but nevertheless significant because of the direction that things seem to take, and in particular, the sort of the downward trajectory of Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party. Just how rough were these recent elections for the Conservatives?
Very. As in this country, local government tends to be a couple of steps removed from national politics. Boris Johnson is a very unconventional politician, to put it politely. I see him as their version of Trump in very subtle but in important ways. We in the British tend to, especially since the beginning of World War II, tend to reflect one another. And to me, he reflects the same kind of populism. The Conservative Party has been decimated, literally, in their local elections. The Labor Party has pretty much held fast. The Liberal Democrats, the third party in Britain, along with the Scottish National Party, the SNP, both did extraordinarily well. It reflects wider dynamics taking place in Britain. Unlike here, their two-party system, which has been firmly in place for about several hundred years, their two-party system, which changes, but it's tended to have two dominant parties, is undergoing great change. And since the 1950s, there has been a slow-motion decline of the two main parties. That's reflected in this election and is really important, but also people's rejection of Boris Johnson. He was in serious trouble before the invasion of Ukraine. He saved himself, at least temporarily. He's written a book about Winston Churchill, and like a lot of other people, including me, he admires the Prime Minister. I think that's genuine on his part. Not a very good book. There are others that I could recommend. But he's been doing a kind of Winston Churchill imitation, and to their credit, the British, as usual, have been, and they have a very, very effective military, I can assure you. The British have been, like the Americans, very assertive and quite rightly supporting the Ukraine people and military against the Russians. That, I think, is temporarily staved off his replacement in the Conservative Party. But I believe his days are numbered and the local elections reflect that. He's a very strange. There is a kind of stability to their politics that is different from our own, and he is a really strange phenomenon in the context of Britain. Mm.
So just to be clear, when you talk about the two major parties
Labor
in Britain—
Labor
and Conservative.
Excuse me.
So these Liberal Democrats, that is, as you said, but just to repeat, that's a third party,
yes.
But it's gaining a lot of ground. And so— But are they gaining at the expense of the Labor Party or the Conservative Party, or maybe both?
I think both in this case. The Labor Party, in the normal duopoly, in the normal dynamics, the Labor Party would be making gains. They have a very British. All three-party leaders are sirs. They were talking about aristocracy dominating things. But Sir Keir Starmer is a very... A barrister, I believe, a lawyer, is a very reasonable sort of British politician and very pragmatic. He's not particularly magnetic, as in the United States. With Trump, Johnson has developed a very powerful, curious but powerful appeal to people, working people who would normally have voted Labor. It's a really interesting phenomenon in that sense, reflecting the fact that a lot of blue-collar people who've been moving away from the Democratic Party, at least since the Eisenhower years, and especially under Reagan, they in Britain have really been supporting Johnson. However, he's a very cynical man, I believe, like Trump, in my view. There were lots of parties going on, including senior government people, including the PM and his wife, his current wife, latest, during the COVID lockdown. The British emphasize fair play. It can be sanctimonious and pompous, but everyday life there really involves a fair amount of integrity. I learned that firsthand as a student dramatically long ago. And they're really offended by the fact that someone at the top would behave this way. Their expectations are higher in that sense.
Rightly so.
Yeah, but it's very much Boris to me. I'm not at all surprised, but the people, especially working people, struggling to make a living, have really become incensed by this this entitlement, the things the rich are always trying to get away with. So that has resonated against him, along with the fact that he, like Trump, he's successful, but there's no strategic vision. There's no consistency to his behavior. And eventually you go under if that's how you approach the world.
Right, right.
I hope that's clear. It's really an interesting phenomenon.
I quite agree. We just have a couple minutes to talk about the recent national election in France and the re-election of Emmanuel Macron. And I think at one point in the column you used the word reassuring.
Yes.
In terms of the results of this election. I think in order to understand that, you need to understand who Marine Le Pen is, his opponent, and his opponent last time as well.
Yes.
I mean, what she represents, and if she had been victorious, what that would have meant for France and Europe and the outer world, for that matter.
Yeah, unlike in Britain, despite what we've been talking about, the Boris Johnson phenomenon, there is established stability since the 1600s and their terrible revolution and civil war. But since that time, Britain has been a politically remarkably stable country with very strong class divisions. That may be changing with the growth of regional nationalism, especially in Scotland, and the fact that the breakaway party in Northern Ireland did very well in the latest election, something I should have mentioned. France is kind of the reverse and has struggled historically to establish political stability. Charles de Gaulle, D-E-G-A-U-L-L-E. If you're really interested in France, learn about Charles de Gaulle.
Yeah, for sure.
He, the hero of World War II, he really brought stability to France. He served as prime minister from 44 to 46, and then prime minister and president from 58 on. The alternative to de Gaulle probably would have been a military coup. There is a very strong right-wing movement in France historically and currently. I believe more Frenchmen served in the Wehrmacht, the German army, than served with the Free French.
Wow.
During World War II. At the beginning of the Free French movement, after the dramatic fall of France in May of 40, Charles de Gaulle refused to surrender, made his way to London with a radio transmitter, a picture of his wife and son, extra pair of socks and underwear and shirt, and maybe that was it, and developed the Free French Movement. The power of the far right in France is extremely important then and now. And since de Gaulle, they've had the institutional strength to bring about stability to what had been a chaotic system. They used to be referred to as the sick man of Europe for that reason. The re-election of Macron, who in many ways is not a particularly attractive leader to the French people, but is effective and is moderate, is significant for that reason.
Well, I'm glad that we can talk about something that's reassuring, and actually there have been a couple of things reassuring through the course of this hour. So.
Right.
It's not all gloom and doom.
Not at all. And we're reopening. Keep that in mind.
Yeah,
yes.
far from it. Absolutely. Very, very true. Dr. Artsir Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business here at Carthage College, and author of After the Cold War. Your columns appear in newspapers across the country, and I am so glad that you are also a frequent guest to the morning show, and Once again, we've had a very, very interesting conversation, which I very, very deeply appreciate. Thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you next month.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. I really appreciate it. It's always educational.
Tomorrow on the morning.